Good evening. If I step over here, can everybody hear me on the microphone? Can you hear me back in the back? Yeah? Okay. Just want to make sure. I want to say first, thanks for the opportunity to get to speak with you tonight. I've only spoken in front of you one other time, but I always really enjoy getting the opportunity to do that. Let me turn this off real fast. There we go. And I also want to say I appreciate, I know, you know, we've just been filled in recently, but I appreciate the elders' work on trying to find somebody to come and be our evangelist here, and I think that's an exciting thing. I was telling Allison about that this afternoon on the phone, and she said she was kind of, you know, she was excited about that, getting somebody else in here too. And if you're wondering where she is, she didn't hear that I was preaching tonight and decide to leave, which is maybe what you think, but she's actually in Indianapolis. She's driving back today, she's driving back tomorrow, she's going to stop in Bowling Green on the way, but her sister just had another baby, so it's kind of an exciting time for them. Everything went really well. Some of the people here, I know Mason had mentioned he knows the Sims, Deidre and Randy Sims. That's their grandchild that was being born. If you guys know them, they're kind of from around this area. I want to say, too, I appreciate in the prayer the thought of, may there be a thus saith the Lord with the sermon that's being presented tonight. And I guarantee you we're going to be, there'll be a lot of thus saith the Lord in this. As a matter of fact, I realize that my goal here is really to get out of the way and let the word speak to you and present it in a way where that I'm not an encumbrance on that at all. So I'm going to do my best to do that. Tonight we're going to be in James. So if you have a Bible, turn there. We're going to be talking about some different concepts in James. And really we're going to go through the first chapter. We're going to go through some of the second chapter of James. And probably have a little summary of the rest of the book, a very quick summary of the rest of the book. Well, not being able to speak to you all that often up here, you know when I do speak to you, I'm trying to tell you something that I really, something that's really pricked my heart, something that's really made me think. And I like to read a variety of things, and recently reading a book really got me thinking. And then I pulled out James, and I started reading through James, and it got me thinking even more. So as I make points, and if I'm ever pointing at you like this is what you need to do, remember I'm kind of pointing at myself first. That's the whole reason I've thought of the things that I wanted to talk about tonight anyway. So I want to go through James and talk about some of the thoughts here. Just to kind of set things up, with the book of James, you know, you'll notice that he says to the 12 tribes who were dispersed abroad. We know every time we open up our New Testaments and we're talking about Christians that are listening to somebody's words, we're talking about people who are probably going through some type of persecution. Let's just face it, the first century Christians had a really, really difficult time. A lot of us really don't understand that, but that's always important to keep within the context of the things that we read. I don't really think anything's different here with the people that James are talking about, the people who are spread out abroad that he talks about. If we get started right now, you'll see in verse 2, he begins with, "Consider it all joy, my brethren, when you encounter various trials." So immediately he's talking about trials, but the weird thing about that is he tells them to consider it all joy. I don't know if you think that's a little bit strange, but I kind of feel like that's strange. Why would a trial be something that is joyful? The difficulties that you've gone through, how would that be something that is joyful? And again, you can imagine the situation that the people are in here and the kind of persecution that they faced, even more so, they may be saying, why am I joyful when I have trials? Well, he kind of answers that question a little bit in the next verse. He says in verse 3, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. And so what you're going to get out of this, you should be joyful because you're going to be able to endure even more. You're going to increase your endurance as a Christian. And they say, okay, well, that makes sense. I should be joyful that then I will increase in endurance, but what does endurance mean? That means I guess I can go through more trials and do even better later on. I kind of don't want to go through trials. I kind of would prefer that the trials stop. So again, why should I be joyful that I'm going through various trials? We'll go to the next verse. He says in verse 4, "And let endurance have its perfect result, so that you may be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing." And I think that's the point he wants to make about being joyful about the trials that you're in. That you can be perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Now, he's not talking about a physical thing. And I'm not going to preach to you tonight that, hey, you're not going to lack anything physically if you just keep enduring, because we know that's not true, and that's not what he's talking about. He's talking about spirituality. He's talking about spiritual things, that they can be perfect and complete and lacking in nothing. It reminds me of Ephesians chapter 5. And Paul says something there. Did you know that Paul tells people to be drunk? Have you guys read that before, that Paul tells people to be drunk? If you go back to chapter 5, you'll read it in there. But what does he say? He says, don't be drunk with wine, which is dissipation. He says, be filled. I like to say, be drunk with the Spirit. And we all understand that concept of being drunk with wine. We understand that. That he says it's dissipation. He says it's a sinful thing. And he's making the point that when you're drunk with wine, we all understand this. If you haven't experienced it yourself, you know people who have, and sadly probably bragged about it later and said, I couldn't remember anything from last night. Best party ever. Couldn't remember anything. Well, I disagree with that. It's not the best party ever. But yeah, you probably couldn't remember anything, because at some point, a certain amount of alcohol, depending on you, is going to push you to the point where you're not thinking very clearly. As a matter of fact, that alcohol is taking over. It's taking control, and you no longer have any control. And that sentiment that I think Paul is saying back in Ephesians is, when you're filled or drunk with the Spirit, you're letting the Spirit of God take control of you. And that's a pretty cool thought. Let the Spirit take complete control over you. I kind of feel like that's the sentiment here. When we talk about being perfect and complete, lacking in nothing spiritually, I think we're talking about being completely filled with the Spirit and letting God's Spirit guide us in our lives. And so then I think maybe, yeah, it is worth enduring through trials to get to that point, to be filled with the Spirit and live your life that way. So James is going to continue on. So he started off talking about these trials, and he's not done yet. He gives an example because he said you'll be full and complete, lacking nothing. He says, but if any of you lacks wisdom, so he gives the example of wisdom. Now, if any of you lacks wisdom, let him ask of God, who gives to all generously and without reproach, and it will be given to him. But he must ask in faith without any doubting. For the one who doubts is like the surf of the sea, driven and tossed by the wind. That man ought not to expect that he will receive anything from God. It just may have been that these people going through difficulties, over a certain amount of time, it starts to wear on you. And maybe when they start to ask God for certain things because they're going through these trials and they haven't really let up that much, that they're starting to think to themselves, well, is God really going to do this for me? I could pray to him, but is he really going to do this? And James is throwing out there right now, yes, he absolutely will, but you better have faith that he will. If you're going to ask him to do something for you, but you kind of don't know if really he's actually going to do it, you don't think he really necessarily will, and you just kind of maybe doubt his ability to, especially if you're going through trials, God certainly has the ability to get me out of those, doesn't he? If you doubt that, he absolutely won't be there with you. But if you don't doubt, and you have full trust and faith in him, you can expect that to be the case, for him to help you. And so he throws that out there, which makes sense for a group of people going through difficulties. Now he goes in verse 9 through verse 11, and he's it's not really a sidebar, I don't think, that he's going through here. I think this is about humility. And you're going to see humility in the book of James many different times, whether the word humble or humility is in there, or you see an example of humility. And that's going to be really, really important. That humility is going to be important to what we're going to talk about really in the second half of this lesson today. But what he says about that is he makes the point about a brother of humble circumstances, how he can glory in his high position as a Christian, whereas a rich person who's had everything actually has to humble himself. He glories in his humiliation because no longer is he so rich and wealthy spiritually. We're all the same. God sees us all the same. No longer is this poor person well beneath me. No, we're brothers now, right here at the same level. So he makes that point, but we're going to come back to humiliation here in just a little bit. In verse 12, he says, blessed is a man who perseveres under trial. So now we're back to, again, he's right on track with enduring, persevering, enduring through trials. He says, for once he has been approved, he will receive the crown of life, which the Lord has promised to those who love him. I think, again, right here, he's trying to convince them, remind them that despite the fact that you're going through difficulties, God is still right here with you, okay? He's still listening to you. If you continue to endure, you will be approved by God, and that is the goal, to be approved by God. And so he says in verse 13, he says, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted by evil, and he himself does not tempt anyone. it's possible, going through trials and them not letting up, that you would start to maybe think this way a little bit. Is this God tempting me? I mean, God is the all-powerful God, but ever since I devoted my life to Christ, it's been difficult. It's been really, really hard, and it hasn't let up. And so he doesn't want them for one second to think that the temptations that they're facing to sin has anything to do with God actually trying to tempt them to sin, because that's not what God does. He throws it out there, but then he says, well, let me tell you where your temptations come from. And he says in verse 14, he says, but each one is tempted when he is carried away and enticed by his own lust. So when lust is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And when sin is accomplished, it brings forth death, spiritual death. So you wanted to know where those temptations to sin are coming from? They're coming from you. They're coming from your heart. They're not coming from God. And you know, Paul talks about extensively that the flesh wages war against the spirit. I mean, you can read about that. He talks about how that is a constant battle where your flesh is trying to do what's wrong, but your spirit within you says, no, I need to be doing what's right. But you have to know that when you're tempted and you're faced with those situations, and all of us have been there, whatever your temptation is, that's not God doing that. That's your own lust, your own heart that is going after those things. And that's important to remember. And so he says, if you continue down, he says in verse 16, do not be deceived. And I like that he just brings that forward. He said, realize that if you do believe these things, and I'm telling you aren't true, you're being deceived. Understand, that's deception, so don't go there. But he says in verse 17, every good thing given and every perfect gift is from above, coming down from the Father of lights, with whom there is no variation, no shifting shadow. In the exercise of his will, he brought us forth through the word of truth, so that we would be a kind of first fruits among his creatures. And again, so right here, he's assuring them that, look, God's not the one doing this. He's the one that gives us every good gift. He's the one, through whom through Christ is coming to us. He sent Christ to us to save us. Every good thing comes from him. And again, we're talking to people who are struggling, who are going through difficulties, and may be starting to question some of these things. But I like what he says in the next verse, verse 19. He says, this you know, my beloved brethren. And for me, that makes the point that this is not brand new to them. These things that James is saying is not something they've really never understood or never known. That's not what it is. He's saying, no, you know these things. I'm just trying to remind you of them. In your time of difficulty, I'm trying to remind you to do the right thing. I'm trying to remind you to think of things the right way. Because when you are going through difficulties, it's easy to get to that point where you start thinking a little differently, a little ungodly, really, because those difficulties are pushing you to a certain point. But don't go there. And I know you already know this, but I just want to encourage you and remind you about it. Now, the next verse is going to be really our next step. I'll say James' next step in what he's trying to say to his listeners. So he's already said, I need you to endure. And here's why you should continue to endure in these difficulties, these trials that you're going through. The next thing that he says, but everyone be quick to hear. Everybody listen. Now that I have told you what you should already know, and I have laid out the arguments for why you should continue to endure, why that is important to you, that it is God who's here to take care of you. He's not the one tempting you. Now that he's laid out those arguments of why, he's going to tell them, now listen up. And he says, be what? Slow to speak. And he says, be slow to anger. And you've heard a lot of people say before, that's why God gives you two ears and one mouth. So you can listen twice as much as you speak. He says, be slow to speak. I need you to listen. And notice when he says, be slow to anger as well, that makes sense that they would maybe get to the point where they're kind of angry. I mean, don't you think if you're constantly being beaten up over and over again, facing difficulties, that you could start to get a little bit angry, a little bit bitter? Absolutely. It has happened before. He doesn't want them to go there either. And so he says, do not be angry. Instead, be quick to hear. And he says in verse 21, he says, therefore, putting aside all filthiness and all that remains of wickedness, in humility, receive the word implanted, which is able to save your souls. So here we are with the idea of humility again. And I think he mentions this because humility is what they absolutely have to have in this situation in order to get to the point where they're even willing to listen to the truth. They have to be humble first and see themselves beneath God. Him as the creator, them as the creation. And so he says, humbly receive the word. Again, receiving the word means listen. So he's made his second point, listen. But now he's going to say, okay, listen, but don't just listen. Okay? Listen, but don't just listen. He says in verse 22, but prove yourselves doers of the word and not merely hearers who delude themselves. So he's now taking it to another level, really another step forward. Now that I have you listening, realize that you need to do more than just listen. You need to be a doer. If in fact all you do is hear and all you do is listen, and that's all you do, you delude yourselves. And listen to the way that he compares the two people right here. I guess contrast, really, the two people. He says in verse 23, for if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. And then when he's gone away, he completely forgets who he is, completely forgets what he's like. He says, so if you're a hearer, you're actually very shallow. You understand, shallow, you have no depth at all. There is no depth to you if all you do is listen to the word. But look at what he says about the next person. Rather than being shallow, in verse 25 he says, but one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides by it, not having become a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer, this man will be blessed in what he does. Look at the difference between these two people. This man looks intently at the law of liberty. What does that mean, to look intently at something? It means to be sharply focused on it. Understand that? Be sharply focused. And I think really what he's getting at here is you need to internalize the truth. So somebody who just listens or just hears the word, hears the truth, they're not internalizing it. Maybe they know it for a little bit, but then they forget about it later because they didn't make it a part of who they are inside. And that's the difference. You have two different ways you could really learn. When you're reading your Bible, for example, or you're listening to somebody like me up here, if you are listening, you could be using your brain to remember everything that I'm saying. Or if you're reading your Bible, you can use your brain to remember everything that you're reading. Or you could use your heart to remember those things. And I think there's a distinction there. I think you guys understand as well. There's a distinction between learning with your brain and learning with your heart. When you learn with your brain, take a Bible verse, for example. Everybody's had a memory verse. If you've been a little kid, you've had a memory verse. You go to Bible class and you have to remember that verse. I think as adults, we probably should have memory verses too. One thing we need to know in life is the word. So you have a memory verse. Well, if you're remembering it with your mind and only your mind, maybe you're doing what I've done before when I was a kid, and it was, okay, I don't want to be the only person who can't remember this thing when I get to class. That's embarrassing. And so out of the fact that I may be embarrassed by not remembering that Bible verse, I make sure that I figure out a way to do it. And you know what? Google memorization techniques, you'll find 100 of them. I mean, there's a ton. You'll find ways to memorize something just like I did. Oh, how am I going to remember this? How basically am I going to take these words that are in front of me and put them back together, form a sentence, and that sentence looks just like what I read in the Bible? That's remembering it with your brain. Remembering it with your heart means you internalize it. You let this become a part of who you are right now. So when you read a passage like, he who believes and is baptized will be saved, at that point, stop and let that become what you actually know in your heart to be true. That, okay, if I'm going to be saved, I have to believe and I have to be baptized. Dwell on that. You know, you see other passages in the Bible that talk about meditating on the word. I think that's the idea. Internalize it. Make it who you are, and you won't be like that guy who has looked at himself in the mirror, walks away, and can't even remember what he looks like or what he is like. You won't be the person who can remember that Bible verse for Sunday, but if I asked you on Wednesday what it was, you'd say, ooh, I don't know. Or if I asked you next week or the week after that, you'd have a hard time recalling it because you didn't internalize it. Internalizing it doesn't mean you're going to remember everything to a T. I understand that. But I also think that you understand there's a difference between memorizing something with your brain and truly making it a part of who you are in here. And that is what this man in verse 25, The man who is intently, sharply focused on the truth, that's what he's doing. He's making it a part of who he is. So if you're like me and you've ever had a goal, I'm going to read this many times a week. I'm going to open up my Bible 4 times a week. I'm going to make sure I read at least 4 times, because if I say all 7 days, I mean, I'm going to fail at that. I don't want to set myself up for failure, so I'm going to read 4 times a week. If I'm just sitting there at night before I go to bed, oh, yeah, I got to hurry up and read that chapter that I want because I have to read. Am I internalizing it at that point, or am I just making it something that, okay, good, I can say I did it? I mean, there's a difference there. Internalize it. And that's what this man does, the man that's not a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer. He remembers things with his heart. At this point, I think we have gotten to, when you look at verse 22, prove yourselves doers of the word, not merely hearers. I think this is the point at which everything, all the way, extending all the way through chapter 4, I think all of that is really kind of under this umbrella. We have a lot of different examples of what it is to be an effectual doer of the word of God, rather than just a hearer. And so you look in chapter 2, starts out with something that probably subtitles the sin of partiality. That's an example, the sin of partiality, that's an example of not being a doer. And actually, at the very end of chapter 1, when he talks about pure and undefiled religion, what is that? That's visiting orphans and widows in their distress. That is being an effectual doer rather than just a forgetful hearer. Knowing that that's a good thing to do and you should do it, and never, ever taking a step out there to actually do it. So the sin of partiality he talks about, he says, my brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. And he goes on to give this example that if somebody really rich comes into your assembly and you pay all the attention in the world to that person, and then somebody poor comes in and you don't pay any attention to him, that is favoritism. And so his example is, no, you're not being an effectual doer. You're being the shallow, forgetful hearer that I just talked about. If you're going to show that kind of partiality, and know this, that is sin. God does not show that kind of partiality. So that is sinful. And he goes on to talk about a little bit in regard to that sin. If you've transgressed the law in one thing, you've transgressed the whole law. So hope that you can receive God's mercy. But he gives that example about partiality to make a point. And he'll continue doing that. You'll notice chapter 3 talks about your tongue and the way you speak. And I think all that has to do, what comes out of your mouth, that's action. The words you speak, that is doing something. You don't have to just be doing something, not speaking, to be doing something. It is action to actually speak. So that what comes out of your mouth will determine whether you're an effectual doer or a forgetful hearer. And he talks about in chapter 3 and verse 13, he says, who among you is wise and understanding? He says, let him show by his good behavior his deeds in the gentleness of wisdom. Again, still talking about behavior. And if you continue on through chapter 4, you'll see all these different things. He talks about the quarrels among them, talks about different things that they're probably struggling with, that they need to understand how an effectual doer behaves in those situations. When you get to chapter 5, I think that's when you have this kind of wrapping up of James. And by the way, we're not wrapping up here, so don't think it's going to be quite that short yet. We're going to go back in just a second. But in chapter 5, I think he's kind of wrapping up his exhortation to them to continue to endure, letting them know they can rely on God. I think there's a strong focus on putting God in everything that's going on in your life, good or bad, making sure that he is there with you. Involve him in everything. And he talks about prayer. And again, when he said at the very beginning of the book, you need to pray to God, he will listen to you. He says that here at the end too. He gives the example. Look at Elijah. 3.5 years he prayed it wouldn't rain, and it didn't rain. And then he prayed it would rain, and it did. God's going to listen to you. If you believe that he will, he'll listen to you. So continue to pray to him. So I think that exhortation at the end of the book is kind of how he wraps it up. And to me, it's very nice and parallel, actually, which is wonderful. All right, now let's go back. We want to go back a little bit because we skipped over a part that we got to talk about. And this is, you know, a big piece of what I've been thinking about a lot lately. Okay, so after this partiality thing, chapter 2 and verse 14, this is something we're all familiar with. What use is it, my brethren, if someone says he has faith but he has no works? Can that faith save him? That's a nice rhetorical question. I think all of us know the answer to that, being good Bible students. We absolutely know the answer to that question. Can that faith save him? Now remember, this is not the first time he's talking about faith and works. I mean, we started this in verse 22 of chapter 1. Prove yourselves effectual doers, not just hearers. A hearer may have faith, but doesn't have works. A doer has both faith and works. We're still talking about that. but he's going to extend it a little bit. And so when he says this, he says, well, can that kind of faith save him if he has faith but he doesn't have works? And then he gives the most ridiculous example. I think the people here would have thought this is the most ridiculous example I've ever heard of in my life. If somebody needed food and somebody needed clothing, and you looked at him and said, hey, have food in your stomach, have clothes in your body, see you later. That doesn't work. That's crazy. That's absolutely crazy. And we understand that. I think they understood it. It's the most ridiculous example. It's so obvious. But you know what else is ridiculous? Faith without works. That's ridiculous. For you to have a faith in God, but not to actually put that into action at any point, that's ridiculous. So you thought that example was ridiculous? Nope. Faith without works, that's just as crazy, is what he's saying there. And then he's going to say something that really is kind of disturbing to me. And you guys have read this verse before too, but it just kind of disturbs me, and it really had me thinking a lot lately. He says in verse 19, you believe that God is one. You do well. The demons believe also, and they tremble, and they shudder. When's the last time you guys read that passage? James, are you saying that I'm no different? If I'm a person with faith and no works, I'm no different than demons who believe? Is that the idea we're looking at here? I think so. Because your faith, not put into action, is completely useless. Faith without works is dead. There's nothing there. And so you take these demons who believe in God. Hey, I believe in God too, yeah. The demons aren't doing anything. They're not doing anything godly, are they? So the belief that they have in God doesn't do anything for them. Why should we expect it would do anything for us either? You know, it'd be a ridiculous thing if somebody came up to you one day and they looked at you and they said, you're evil. You are evil. And you said, well, why are you calling me evil? I don't get it. Did you dig up something about my past and know something that I don't even know? I don't know. Why are you calling me evil? They say, well, because you're just evil. You know what evil is. Okay. Yeah, I know what evil is. You have the knowledge of evil. You know who Satan is, don't you? Well, yeah, I know who Satan is. And you know that demons exist, don't you? Yeah, it says it right there. But yeah, I know demons exist. Do you know what murder is? Absolutely. I know what murder is. Well, you're evil. Why? Because you have the knowledge of evil. Now raise your hand if you think that's logical. Because you have the knowledge of evil, you are evil. Raise your hand if you think that makes perfect sense. Then don't for a second think that having the knowledge of good makes you good. Knowledge of good doesn't do anything for you unless you're doing something about it. And I say that ridiculous example because as that came to me, it slapped me in the face. Absolutely slapped me in the face. But I need to be thinking about that. How useless is my faith? You know, there are some other things to think about in regard to this. I don't know if you guys recently saw a teacher, and this unfortunately has happened too many times recently. But there's that teacher. She's like a junior high teacher. And she has slept with some of her students, multiple students. There's one in particular I guess they're getting her for. And recently, the judge sentenced her to 6 months in prison, which, of course, there's outrage because of that. 6 months in prison? She'd been sleeping with this minor, and it's a terrible thing. You shouldn't be doing that. And the judge evidently commented and said, well, that was just out of character for you. Okay? I don't know how the judge knows who that lady is. I don't know. Maybe they're friends from back in the day. Maybe it's her dad. I have no idea. But what he told her was, that's out of character for you. But you know what? No, it's not. I mean, think about it. Whenever you've done something wrong, and you've even had your friends, your good friends, maybe even your family, and maybe you've told yourself this because it's popular in America. Ah, that's not you. Man, that is not you. I know you're better than that. You are absolutely better than that. You just slipped up, but you are much better than that. I got news for you. You're not better than that. And neither am I. Whatever I do in my life, that's who I am. That lady who is sleeping with young kids, that is her character. That is who she is. Can it change? Absolutely. But don't delude yourselves. Don't deceive yourselves and think that, oh, well, that's not really me. No, that's exactly who you are. Your actions show exactly who you are. So I started to think about that with myself. Am I apathetic? There are a lot of different things I can think about for myself. What am I doing to prove my faith? Understand that? I say I have faith. You should be able to look at me and say, prove it. What am I doing to prove that faith? These are the things that I have been just mulling over for a little while. I was reading a book recently that really kind of started to stir this stuff up. I had been around at that time, even around a couple of people that are just fantastic people and make me feel like I just am pretty much nothing because they're that fantastic. And then reading through James, I see this emphasis on faith and works. And we've all heard about that many, many times. But what am I doing myself to actually show my faith to others and prove that I actually am dedicated to God, I trust in Him, I have all the faith in Him possible? What am I doing? And I think that's worth thinking about. If the demons can believe and be deathly afraid, I guess I can believe and really have no depth to me and have no worth and be completely dead myself. So these are things I really wanted us to think about tonight. I have no doubt there are a lot of good people in here that do a lot of good things. And if you're one of those people that you feel like, I really put my faith into action day after day after day, share that with each other. Not to say, hey, look at me, look at all the good things I'm doing. It'll be obvious if you have those intentions. Don't have that intention. Instead, share with other people the things that you're doing, because I guarantee you there are a lot of people sitting out here right now that are thinking, well, I'd like to put my faith into action, but what? I don't really know what to do. I just don't know what to do. Maybe you do stand up for yourself as a Christian day to day, but what other things can you be doing? People share that with each other, because we need a group of Christians that have more than just a faith, that have actions to back them up. If you're somebody tonight who absolutely believes that you need to believe in God and believe in Jesus the Christ as your Savior and you need to be baptized, that is your call to action if you haven't done so. If you are somebody who is a Christian, somebody who's, if you're like me, I grew up in the church. I've been worshiping. I'm 30 years old. I've been worshiping since I was a kid for 30 years. Some of you have more than double that in your lifetime. But can you honestly say you never were at a point where your faith really wasn't in action? Because I can't say that. I think there's been many points, arguably up until now, where my faith really hasn't been in action. And I'm more dead than I thought I was. If that's you, let us know. Come up here and talk to us. Talk with each other if you're not going to come up here. And let's figure that out and all put our faith into action together. Okay? If we can help you with anything, please come as we stand and sing.